Predators, of course, coming off a shutout victory over the Leafs here on Tuesday night. They actually shut out Toronto twice this year, both times. Pretty interesting stat. Only the second team to ever do that in Leafs history in a season series. Oh, with that being said, let's head up to Toronto. Let's bring in Richard Deitch from The Athletic. It's what a coincidence that I had that stat there ready right before Richard. Richard, how you doing?
Nothing like the Predators to remind you of what an elite team is if you're a Toronto Maple Leafs fan.
I was shocked that Toronto only mustered up 40 shots in both meetings this year, and the Predators outscored them 7-0 in two shutouts. I mean, Toronto's obviously a really good team, but I've been surprised at how they've looked against the Preds this year.
Well, Pecorine is a good goalie, and obviously he played really, really well against the Maple Leafs. You know, the Maple Leafs came into that game really struggling. They probably played their best game in five games. And defensively, they were pretty good. You know, a couple mistakes, obviously. Predators capitalized. But there's a gap. There's a gap between the elite teams in the league, like Nashville, like Tampa Bay. I'd probably put Boston on there. You know, maybe put Calgary on there now, San Jose, and Toronto. And the hope here, and honestly, it feels more like a 30-70, 40-60 hope, is that when the playoffs come around, the offense could really get going and Freddie Anderson will stand up, and that's how they're going to win. But there's something off. That's not really true. I think the expectations in Toronto, because it's the hockey capital of Canada, are always outsized. And I think because they have such great offensive players, they're really outsized. But it's clear that there are teams above them right now, and until they get their back line a little bit better, they're going to be behind the Predators. I will say, Predators look good. I mean, that defensively, that is a really, really good team. The West is not easy, but I give Nashville as good a shot as anybody.
Interesting. What did you make of Major League Baseball kicking off their regular season in Japan? Most people had no clue the Mariners and A's played a meaningful game, and it actually counted, and there's still like a week and a half of spring training left, and there they are playing games that count in the standings in Japan. What do you make of that?
You guys got a cash register sign somewhere or a sound effect somewhere?
Cha-ching. Cha-ching.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the league is about promoting its product outside of its shores, and Japan is a very good market for Major League Baseball, given all the Japanese players that have played here. And so they're going to sell out those games. They're going to sell a lot of merchandise. They're going to be able to globally extend their brand into Japan. I don't know what the league's, television deal is in Japan or streaming or whatever else, but there's no doubt it could be a lucrative market. So that's what that is. If you're Major League Baseball, your calculation, and I think in this case I'll probably be right, your calculation is that opening day on the 28th is still going to get everybody excited domestically, stateside, and that people are not going to, like, all of a sudden think, okay, well, they played these games in Japan, so this is not the quote-unquote opening day. You know, ESPN will have all its games on during the whole day, and people will be talking about baseball for as much as they talk about baseball on opening day. So they'll be able to still get the benefits of an opening day. But I think the thing that's the weirdest thing about this to me, it's not that necessarily the games were in Japan. It's that they're like 10 days before the start of the regular season.
Yeah, before.
That's the odd part. Like, if this would have happened on like the 26th, the 27th, 28th, you know, I'm like, all right, that's kind of interesting. You guys are starting the year somewhere else. It's so far away from the actual start of the season that the standings sit there, you know, with two teams that have already played. They have statistics. So, like, if you're a fantasy baseball player, like, those statistics already exist, and you got to wait another 7 days for the season. That's the odd part to me.
Yeah, I mean, the Texas Rangers and the Nashville Sounds are playing an exhibition game in our city on Sunday, and Major League Baseball has already had games that count. That doesn't make any sense.
And by the way, break up the Mariners. They look like they're going to win 162 this year.
They're on pace.
They're off to a really good start. You know, you just had an interesting conversation with some folks who do podcasts, and obviously that's a big thing here. Willie and I just had Ida and Julie in studio with us for an hour, a wife and a fiance of two Predators players, and they've been doing these podcasts and getting a lot of notoriety. They went on NHL Network, and who knows, maybe you can talk to them down the road. But you got a chance to talk to an interesting group of podcasters. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so in the latest – first of all, thank you for this free promo. In the latest sports media podcast, I have four different sports podcast shows on where they go behind the scenes and just tell me how they do what they do, why they do it, how many downloads they have, how long it takes them to put together each week, why they're in podcasting, how they hope they could grow. And the two most known ones that I did, I intentionally tried to do people sort of a different level. So we have like a super independent one, then a semi-independent one, then a couple mainstream ones. And the biggest one I have is a guy named Conrad Thompson. If you are a wrestling fan, you've probably heard of him. He brilliantly, in my opinion, capitalized on the nostalgia for 1980s and 1990s wrestling and put these shows together with three people who were known at that time. Bruce Pritchard, who was played Brother Love in the WWE but was also an executive. Eric Bischoff, who ran WCW and also was a big part of WWE. And Tony Schiavone, who was essentially the voice of WCW, the voice of Southern wrestling for a long time. And rather than talk about what's going on in today's wrestling storylines, he has these guys on, and they just basically take a very small thing from the past, and they do like 2 or 3 hours on what happened behind the scenes, the finances of the time, the conflicts of the time, and it's really fascinating. And the guy has just hit it out of the park. He's got three podcasts that probably average like well over 500,000 downloads each week.
Wow.
He's making a ton of money, seven figures for sure. And he's extended his podcast brand where he does these live shows around the country. So, you know, like he and Bruce Pritchard will do like, will go to Huntsville or Nashville or New York. They'll rent out like a comedy club or some kind of small theater, charge money, and people are paying, you know, he's getting like 400, 500 people to come and sort of do a live show. You know, you add all this money up, the guy created a seven-figure business, and in his real life, he's just a mortgage broker. So he's the most interesting guy that I spoke with. I talked to Greg Wyshynski and Emily Kaplan. They do the ESPN on Ice podcast. And, you know, again, certainly talented people, but what Thompson did is amazing to me because he sort of just created this major business out of his own brain. I will say this, though. It does help. He is married to one of Ric Flair's daughters, so he is in the world, so to speak. Not Charlotte Flair, by the way, the other one of the other Flair daughters. But he's just an interesting guy, and that was really – every time I've talked to him, I found what he has done fascinating because he just created this mega business essentially out of his love for professional wrestling.
Seven figures. Wow.
Yep. Seven. Yeah, he is making more than $1 million a year on this podcast between the live shows and all that stuff. Now, I don't know if he's bringing it all in because he obviously has these guys he works with and he has a staff now. But think about that. He created a seven-figure podcast on wrestling nostalgia. There are other seven-figure podcasts. You know, trust me, Joe Rogan, Adam Carolla, the Part of My Take guys, they're making seven figures as well. But this guy did it with wrestling nostalgia, which is just, you got to tip your hat to him.
Richard Deitch is with The Athletic. He is the author of The Media Circus. Great way to keep up on what's going on in the sports media world. And Richard, you pointed this out. I think we all agree, and you're like, part of you is saying, well, duh, you should have known this a long time ago. But you do have to give CBS and their crew credit for adjusting back to the way we all want to see the brackets unveiled, where they get right to it, and then they do the analysis after it's over, where before they were trying to tease you, they're trying to make you wait as long as you could possibly wait for the wrong reasons.
Phenomenal job by CBS. They listened to the criticism that TBS got last year, which was robust and correct. 2 years ago, CBS extended that selection show where I wrote about this, remember, 77 minutes it took them to get to the whole bracket. I mean, think about that, 77 minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
This year, no fooling around, one-hour show. They got to the entire bracket in 35 minutes. They opened the show up 2 minutes in, first bracket. Great, best show I've seen in years. Universally on social media and other places, they were praised and deserved to be praised. A great example of a network listening to its fan base, changing on the fly, and getting rewarded for it. The good news is it doesn't always happen, but the good news, their viewership number was the most in 5 years. So that's cool. that's an example of everybody winning, including CBS. And I think Turner has the show next year. I'm not sure about this, but I think so. I would think Turner does not have, as we would say, the cojones to go back to what they did 2 years ago. I have to think that this is the show heading forward, and it should be. You know, you want don't play games. Don't hide the brackets for a couple hours and sort of just give us analysis, blah blah blah. Like that's about getting those brackets out, getting excited about starting to fill out the brackets, and we'll watch. What we don't want is to sort of get this bait and switch where you say it's the selection show, but, 77 minutes in is when we finally get the selection.
No doubt about it. One thing that I guess is new this year, Gene Steratore is going to be sort of on site from the studio to go with rules violations, rules interpretations, things like that. Has that ever happened in the NCAA tournament before?
I don't think so, but he, people know Steratore from an NFL referee, but
sure.
He was a Big Ten referee for a long time. He's a basketball ref, so I think that's a good addition. How much it'll come up, I don't know. A lot of times basketball is one of those things where you have enough replays and video where it's not like the NFL. It's sort of rather apparent, but, if it's a big moment and there's some kind of technical decision that the viewers should be informed about, it's a good asset to have Steratore in the studio, and at the Final Four he'll be on site, just to be able to go to him. I would not expect to see him a ton every day, but, there may be one or two things where you bring the guy on to sort of explain why a ruling was made. But, the thing about basketball, I'm not telling you or your audience anything you don't know, so much of it is subjective, in terms of what's a foul, what's not a foul. And it's not like the NFL. I think having a guy just basically say, well, I think that should have been a foul, or that should have been a non-call, you could sort of also do that with your own eyes, basically. It's a little different than football.
Well, one thing I do want to ask you, because I feel like it's going to be a big thing throughout the tournament, is the reviews at the end of the game, which are excruciating to watch. It's been happening throughout the regular season, and it's only going to get magnified, I think, in these very important games, where in the last minute, in particular the call that I'm talking about is – two guys go for the ball. It goes out of bounds. In the past, referee makes the call. You go on. Now, it's almost like the referee knows he doesn't even have to make a call. He's just going to go over and look at the monitor anyway. And you really can't tell on at least 50% of these plays. And yet the game is going to get delayed. Both teams get a free timeout. There could be situations where a team doesn't have a timeout, but they get to huddle up and do whatever they want to do over there. So do you think that the kind of in the fold that you just said, Richard, that CBS, they heard the criticism, they moved on. Do you think college basketball will be sort of shamed into adjusting, maybe going to a challenge system instead of just every call in the last minute? It happens in the NBA, too, as well.
It's possible, Willie. I'm not as down on this as you, because I like, I'm again, as a viewer, I'm okay with the delay if you ultimately get the right call. And the reason I say that is because I'm a longtime soccer fan, and it was very frustrating watching global soccer or World Cup soccer when that a goal was actually either scored or not scored, and they refused to use goal line technology, and now they finally have. So I'm okay with the delay, and yes, I get that it's an advantage for a team that doesn't have timeouts, and I get that it does take away from the drama of the game, but I'm someone who likes technology being accurate, because I think that's the fairest thing to the players and the programs. That said, it is an entertainment vehicle, and things like challenges and stuff like that will help the speed of stuff, and I would not be surprised if that happens. But I would just rather they get it right, and I could live with the three-minute delay. But, again, I've watched every Raptors game, obviously, for my job up here, and you are correct. I mean, like, literally, it feels like 15 of the 65 games. In the last 2 minutes, there's a long delay as the refs try to figure out, an out-of-bounds call.
One thing we did appreciate here Tuesday night, puck drop was at 7 o'clock. The game was over by 9:20. And you brought up the soccer
nice
reference. Man, it felt like a soccer. It was like, wow, okay, we could get used to games being this quick. I don't know if that'll be the case tonight, but it was nice. We took it for a game.
And then everybody goes out in Nashville, which is a very lively party city, and so everybody wins.
Oh, there's no doubt. In fact, Josh Yoey joined us from The Athletic last hour here at the desk with us, who covers the Penguins, and he said 2 years ago in the Stanley Cup Final, there were Pittsburgh media that ended up in the hospital from their visits to Nashville.
Wow, way to get your amateur status checked. The old hospital check-in as a sports writer.
No doubt. Hey, always good to talk to you. Thanks for doing this.
See you guys.